From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, a new report out this week finds that terrorists are likely to use weapons of mass destruction against the U.S. within the next 5 years.
First, though, the big three U.S. automakers rushed to get their restructuring plans to Congress today. And later this week, the CEOs of GM, Ford, and Chrysler will be on Capitol Hill to make their case that they need $25 billion in bailout money.
There is also word that union auto workers are calling an emergency meeting in Detroit to figure out ways they can help cut costs. We're joined now by Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Radio News. Dustin, what's the latest about this UAW meeting?
Well, first, I should say we don't have any direct knowledge of the meeting. It's supposedly a private meeting, but there have been plenty of reports out there, plenty of leaks. And what we know is that leaders from around the country, leaders from UAW locals, have been called to Detroit tomorrow to discuss possible changes to the union contract. You know, it's important because there's a lot of talk of concessions from the UAW as part of this plan to give $25 billion in loans to the car companies. But any concessions would have to be approved by the members. The UAW is a democratically run organization, so members would have to vote.
Speaking of concessions, the head of Ford said that he will work for just a dollar for the year if any government bailout money is taken by his company. What else do we know about the plans from the big three being presented today in D.C.?
Well, we have the full plan from Ford so far. It's a 33-page document, at least the public version of it is. Ford says it will spend $14 billion developing alternative technology vehicles over the next couple of years. It says it will have an electrically powered van for commercial fleets in 2010, an electrically powered sedan by 2011. And again, Ford's CEO said he would take a dollar a year salary only if Ford accepts that $9 billion in loans that it's requesting. GM and Chrysler have not fully released details of their plans yet, but there are some leaks out there. Again, GM CEO Rick Wagoner is reportedly also going to take a $1 a year salary, and we haven't heard yet from Chrysler.
The CEOs of the big three didn't get such a great response last time they went to Congress. What are their chances now that they've submitted these more detailed plans for restructuring?
Of course, we'll have to find out when the vote happens. But I think that there are a number of members of Congress who wanted to support these loans the first time around, but they just didn't feel like there were enough details. Now that the details are out there and some of these other embarrassing issues such as executive pay, corporate jets have been addressed, it's possible that some members will find it easier to support these loans.
Dustin, you're there in Michigan. How is all of this feeling there? How concerned are residents of the state about what's going on this week?
I mean, this is the most important thing to people in Michigan right now. This affects everyone here. I mean, I just talked to a woman the other day who worked for a healthcare company, and she lost her job. She's now competing against Ford and GM engineers in the marketplace to get a job. So there's no one here that isn't touched by this. And a lot of people are sort of baffled by the response around the rest of the country because they saw how easily Wall Street got its bailout and how hard it is for Detroit to get its money, and people just sort of see a double standard there.
The last time that the heads of the big three appeared in D.C., they caught a lot of flack for how they arrived. This time around, I hear that at least GM head Rick Wagoner will be driving there in a Chevy Malibu. Any word on how the other two CEOs will arrive?
Yeah, Ford CEO Alan Mulally will be driving a hybrid as well, either an Escape hybrid or a Mariner hybrid. No word yet from Chrysler CEO Robert Nardelli, but you can bet that he won't be flying in on a corporate jet. Also, I should mention that both GM and Ford have now announced that they're completely eliminating their corporate jet functions at this point.
Dustin Dwyer is a reporter with Michigan Radio News. Thanks, Dustin.
No problem.
Here's a novel idea for how to fix the auto industry. Nationalize it, or at least nationalize the biggest American car maker, GM. That's Los Angeles Times car columnist Dan Neal's idea. And Dan, you mean basically just stop fooling around with bridge loans or anything like that and just outright buy GM?
Yeah, I don't see that the federal money that they're talking about really will save GM. I also think that, you know, we should just be intellectually honest about this. If this money, federal money, is going to come with all these conditions, including the idea that the Congress is going to weigh in and adjudicate their future business plans. I mean, it's nationalization. Just call it that and embrace it and move on.
What would be the advantages to owning GM?
It'd be cheaper than a loan that we'd never get back. Also, General Motors is a very, very strong company with, you know, something like $50 billion in real assets. And it's done a lot of the work to turn itself around. That's one of the ironies, is that it was turning the giant ocean liner around when it happened to hit an iceberg, which was the credit crisis and some other problems that have made their chronic liabilities acute. But I think General Motors is a good investment.
Really?
I mean,
people are saying this car company doesn't get it. It's sort of, you know, dead in the water. It hasn't been forward looking. It hasn't developed the kinds of cars that people want now.
Look, they have made so many management mistakes. But along with that, they've made some very, very smart moves. And this is a company that's very strong and robust around the world. It's the North American market that's killing them. And there's a long thread of historical reasons why General Motors has been at such a disadvantage in North America since the 70s. But the net of it is that this company has a lot of potential, but it also has the potential to sink right out from under us.
So aside from it being potentially a good deal for the government to own GM, what are the other benefits or possible benefits?
Well, we're at the stage where we are requiring these companies, these publicly traded corporations designed to make money, to operate in the public good. I've heard, I would say, dozens of people say they should have been investing in small, fuel-efficient cars, plug-in hybrids, electrics, and instead of building trucks and SUVs. Well, trucks and SUVs was where the money was, right? They were operating responsibly insofar as they were making the product that had the most profit built into it. You know, and free market capitalism is great at responding to market needs, but it's lousy at anticipating needs. The advantage of nationalizing GM is that you could allow this company to get ahead and build the cars we know we will need, if not necessarily the ones we, you know, must have at the second. A big problem with electrics and hybrids and all these other things is that the batteries are so expensive, there is no clear way to make a profit on these vehicles. So one of the things going to happen in Congress is that senators and congressmen are going to demand that GM build these very expensive vehicles at a loss. Well, what kind of business plan is that? So I say nationalize the company, build these cars at a loss, and address the larger public policy issue, which is, of course, oil and climate change. I see this as a golden opportunity to transform the auto industry in the service of the public good. A decade from now, if they're still in business, they'll have figured out a way to build cars and trucks at a profit. But right now, we need them to build a special kind of vehicle, and I think at a loss.
Dan, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madeline.
That's Dan Neal. He's the automobile columnist for the Los Angeles Times. His column about nationalizing GM is in today's paper.
Sometime during the next 5 years, the U.S. can expect a terrorist attack using biological, possibly even nuclear weapons. That's the findings of a study coming out this week from a bipartisan group called the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. Here to tell us more about that report is the vice chair of the commission, former senator from Missouri, Jim Talent. Welcome to the program, sir. And if you could tell us a bit about this report, it states that the biological threat to this country is greater than the nuclear one. What sort of biological threat are we talking about?
Well, people normally think in terms of like anthrax, and that's the most visible potential pathogen. There's others that could be used, smallpox, for example. And one of the dangers is that with DNA synthesizers that are available and dual-use technology all over the world, it's becoming increasingly easy to isolate pathogens, old or new. It's technologically easier to weaponize.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you conducted the research for this report?
We're a follow-on to the 9/11 Commission, congressionally created, bipartisan. The report was unanimous, and we interviewed hundreds of people, travel all over the world, everywhere from the national labs in Sandia to London to Asia to Russia, interviewing people. And then each of us on the commission has experience in this area as well. And what Congress wanted was an update on the assessment of the threat and then recommendations about what can be done to reduce it.
According to your report, where might such an attack occur?
That's so speculative that we didn't say this city or that city. There are obvious ones that know their targets or potential targets: New York, London. It could happen in a in a more rural or suburban area, but probably a population center for the obvious reason that they get, unfortunately, more casualties if they can do a weapon of mass destruction in a place like New York.
This report also looked at who could possibly pose this sort of threat, where they're based. What were the findings there?
Al-Qaeda is probably still the lead terrorist group. There are others, as we're seeing or could be seeing in India right now. Some of them are regional in nature. But the problem is that these terrorists all have organizationally the sophistication to get the technology to use one of these weapons, and we know that they have the desire to do it. We don't think they have the capability yet, but they have the sophistication to get it. And in terms of bio, if they recruit the right, you know, bioscientist or two, they get the technical capability.
Do the recent bombings last week in Mumbai add any weight to this report?
What it does is to point out the nature of the struggle that we're involved in, whether you call it a war or a conflict or whatever. We're dealing with transnational conspiracies who are empowered by the information revolution, by the forces of globalization. They know, they see the world as a number of systems, you know, matrixes of systems stuck together, and they know we're vulnerable at a lot of different points, and that's the reason we're seeing more and more groups using these kinds of methods. They're formidable. I mean, nobody should think of this as a terribly unequal struggle between, you know, the international community and the terrorists. They're a formidable opponent, and we need to act across a broad spectrum to stop them.
So what can be done about this opponent?
We have a lot of recommendations we think are very practical that can be done. Some of them are internal to the government themselves. They're internal changes Congress needs to make so that it can be more effective in this, and other commissions have recommended them. Now let's do it. Let's get it done. We want the life science community to work with the government about how to self-regulate. In other words, what kind of protocols can we use so that we can keep track of high containment labs better? And then we say we need to emphasize Pakistan. It's funny that this report's coming out now because we saw in the course of this that Pakistan is an epicenter for all of these risks that we're talking about.
Jim Talent, former senator from Missouri, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. President-elect Barack Obama appeared today at the National Governors Association Conference in Philadelphia. He promised to move quickly on an economic recovery plan.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was among those at that meeting. Just yesterday, he declared a fiscal emergency for California, a projected $28 billion deficit over the next year and a half.
The problem for Governor Schwarzenegger remains how to break the political gridlock among his legislators. From Sacramento, John Myers of member station KQED reports.
It's hard to escape the movie reference. For a man whose first big comedy was called Kindergarten Cop, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's reaction last week to the California legislature's inaction was priceless.
You could see it's like a kindergarten up there where they pointed fingers at each other. I told you this, I told you that, and all those kind of things. They did not live up to the challenge of what they ought to do.
Schwarzenegger has argued all year long that both parties should stop standing on principle and follow his lead, a combination of cuts in state spending and tax increases. The governor said Monday it's not a good solution, but it's the only solution.
I know this is a terrible time to raise taxes, but it is also a terrible time to make cuts in very important programs.
Schwarzenegger's fiscal emergency declaration starts a 45-day clock running at the State House in Sacramento. If legislators fail to pass budget solutions by then, they must stop work on all other issues until compromise is reached. The governor's plan, announced last month, includes an immediate $4 billion cut in public school funding and a sales tax increase totaling almost $11 billion by the summer of 2010. But that proposal found no support in the California legislature that adjourned last week. And even the new crop of legislators who took office Monday seem hesitant to jump on board. Instead, GOP lawmakers want to turn to something Schwarzenegger himself pitched years ago, streamlining state government. Mike Valines is the leader of Republicans in the California Assembly.
There's still a lot of wasted money. You have three departments in the state of California that all do something about pesticide regulation. Get rid of two, put it in one. Things like that are symbolic. I know it won't be a huge cut, but when you start doing those things, then Californians will say, okay, we're open to a discussion on other things.
It is not an answer to say, well, government just needs to be more efficient, therefore we're not going to solve the problem.
Daryl Steinberg is the new president pro tem of the California Senate. He admits several years of state budgets that relied on borrowing have made taxes and spending cuts that much harder to swallow. But he says talking about small fixes without a tax increase ignores the depth of the problem.
We're not going to see California go off the cliff. We're not going to do it. Not going to happen. Not going to happen under my watch.
State lawmakers are also faced with a new problem, a lack of cash. The economic crash has even further depressed tax revenues, so much that the state could run out of cash in February just to pay its monthly bills. Some have suggested the state get help from the federal government. Governor Schwarzenegger, who today is attending a national meeting of governors in Philadelphia, hopes to bend the ear of another attendee, President-elect Obama. The subject? Federal money for infrastructure projects, providing jobs and boosting California's economy.
We can put shovel into the ground literally the day after he becomes president. That's how ready we are. So we want to talk about that, because if we do that and if we get federal money to build this infrastructure, that will put, tens of thousands of people to work.
Schwarzenegger even hearkened his call for government help in creating jobs to Franklin Roosevelt, a seemingly far leap for the Republican who has a bronze bust of Ronald Reagan in his office. Then again, these are challenging times, and Arnold Schwarzenegger prides himself on pragmatism, even if others sometimes see him in less flattering terms. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
You know, it's hard to believe, but sometimes a member of Congress voluntarily decides to leave the glamorous life on Capitol Hill. He or she isn't forced out, doesn't lose an election, isn't lured to higher office. Some 24 lawmakers this year are leaving all of their own accord. NPR's Brian Naylor reports on one departing member of Congress, an Illinois Republican.
Ray LaHood stands in his soon-to-be former office in the Longworth Building across Independence Avenue from the Capitol. There are scenes like this every 2 years in Washington, departing members packing up their photos and papers, staffers on the phone looking for new jobs. But Ray LaHood is anything but melancholy as he prepares to return to his hometown of Peoria.
I'm not being carried out. I'm not being prosecuted out. I'm not being voted out. I'm going out on top. And I'm very proud of that. I mean, it's an accomplishment around here after 14 years to walk out with a sense of accomplishment and pride in knowing that we did what the people wanted and we're going out on our own terms.
LaHood was first elected to Congress in 1994, succeeding the man he had served as chief of staff, former Republican leader Bob Michael. LaHood was part of the freshman GOP class that won control of the House for the first time in a generation. But he was not the revolutionary some of his colleagues were. He never signed the contract with America and was not afraid to buck party leaders on occasion. He says the GOP has to broaden its appeal if Republicans hope to regain a congressional majority.
Our party has to come to grips with the idea that we are a very diverse country, and our party is very diverse. And we're not just one theology, we're just not one philosophy. And I think once we come to grips with that, that is the starting block from which we build the party.
LaHood has been a tireless advocate of civility in Congress and bipartisanship, concepts that seldom prevailed during his time in Washington. But he has high hopes for the new Congress and President-elect Obama.
He will set a new tone, and it will be genuine. This is not made up. He believes this, and I believe he will get people to work together, and we will begin to turn the economy around. And it won't just be with Democrats. If Republicans are smart in the House and Senate, they'll see that this guy has a vision, this President Obama has a vision, but it could only be done in a bipartisan way.
LaHood was a familiar figure who often presided over the House chamber as the acting speaker, holding the gavel during some contentious debates. He was known for his even-handed treatment of Republicans and Democrats and his knowledge of House rules. LaHood says his most memorable moments in Washington weren't so much what he did as what he saw.
And I'm going to be able to say, when the history books are written, I can tell my grandchildren, I was in Washington on 9/11. I was sitting in the chair when the House attempted to impeach a president. And so many of these things that will be in the history books, I watched before my very eyes.
LaHood says he will miss the people he worked with in Congress, but not the weekly trips back and forth from Peoria. His seat was held by Republicans on November 4th. LaHood's replacement will be Aaron Schock, who at age 27 will be the youngest member of the new Congress. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Kellen.
I'm Madeline Brand. In a few minutes, how a former investment banker traded the high life for a higher calling.
First, though, today we offer a belated happy birthday to Zach Sunderland. Zach turned 17 on Saturday. He celebrated alone, and we mean really alone. Here is a familiar voice. It's NPR's Alex Chadwick. And as he reports, the Southern California teen is trying to become the youngest person to sail around the world solo.
I saw Zach 6 months ago on a dock in Los Angeles on his 36-foot sloop. He and the Intrepid are now a little more than halfway around the world, and it's been interesting getting there.
The first thing I said to him is, have you loaded your gun? He said, yeah, my gun is loaded.
Lawrence Sunderland, dad and role model. Zach called on the sat phone several weeks ago from the Indian Ocean. He was frightened. There was an ominous boat tracking him, drawing near. And this is what Lawrence told his 16-year-old son.
Okay, Zach, your gun's loaded. You're going to have to go out there and shoot. Don't shoot to wound these. You're going to have to shoot to kill, because if they're armed and they're pirates, they're going to kill you. They'll kill you, and they'll take your boat.
The boat followed a while longer and then turned away. Not the worst moment in this quest.
This hopefully will be Zach right now on the telephone.
Hi, Zach.
Good, Mom and Dad.
Good, how are you?
That's his mom, Marianne. More from Zach in a moment. Now, we're in the dining area of the family home outside L.A. It's comfortable and crowded. This is not a wealthy family, more sailors than yachters. Lawrence manages big boats and sells them. There are six other kids, ages 15 to 1.5, all homeschooled. There's a world map taped to one wall. Everyone's kind of studying marine geography.
There's Mauritius right there.
Yeah.
Its next leg is to Durban, and off of Madagascar, there's a storm that lives there.
Lawrence, pointing to the Indian Ocean near southern Africa, where, as we speak, Zach is steering the Intrepid away from the continental shelf off Madagascar.
And if you're inside that continental shelf, that's where you get the 40, 50, and 60-foot waves.
If you have children, you must be thinking what I am. Okay, for Zach, how do Mom and Dad get through this? But things that sound dangerous are less so if you know more about them. And Lawrence and Marianne are watching the weather charts and talking to Zach every day, providing guidance.
There's a storm that rolls through the Southern Ocean every 3 days. We'd heard that, but now that we have the forecasting software, you can actually see them. They're huge, spiraling masses. They're purple, which means heavy winds, you know, just rolling every 3 days they come by.
The worst. 3 weeks ago, Zach still crossing the Indian Ocean. A big, big storm. Night. The rigging starts to come apart. He goes on deck. The big waves rolling down. A wild sail torn and beating free. He pulls things back as best he can because he's alone. And that's what you have to do.
He nearly got knocked off the boat several times. And although he had a harness on, when you're on the bow of a boat, if you're going to fall over, there's pretty much no chance of getting back on the boat.
At one point, he said, I'm so exhausted, I can't do this anymore. I have to sleep. And I said, then you have to sleep. You have to take care of you. And he did. He went down below, he fell asleep, and he woke up. The seas had calmed down to maybe 8 to 10 feet, and the sail had stopped flogging. So it was like this horrible situation just resolved. So, yeah, that was something.
I did talk to Zach. The ocean he's heading into, the Cape of Good Hope at South Africa, you can hope for good, but expect storms.
They're really fast moving down here, and there's not much you can do. You have to be really, really careful on this leg, leaving it a little bit late in the season now, so in a little bit more danger. I mean, from what I hear, no one really gets off on unscathed.
Explore the world, discover yourself. Zach is on schedule to become the youngest round-the-world sailor, though another youngest round-the-world attempt began a couple of weeks ago. Even if Zach does make it, his record may not last. But he'll be back here, safe at Harbor again, and with a small crowd waiting in welcome. We'll check back with him before then. Alex Chadwick, NPR News, Marina Del Rey, California.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day and some tips about how you can squeeze some money into your budget for holiday shopping and you don't even have to get another job. No, with a cool, unsentimental eye, think about what you could live without and start digging in your closet, in your garage, and hold a yard sale, sell online, or go to a consignment shop. Day to Day's personal finance contributor, Michelle Singletary, is here to tell you how to do it. Michelle, first step? Hi.
Well, you know, I think one of the most effective ways, the tried and true way, is to have a garage sale. I always tease people who have garages, where's your car parked? And 9 out of 10 times, it's parked in the driveway because you have so much stuff in your garage. And then go through your house, go through your closets, your kids' closets. I mean, there are a lot of women out there who have clothes in their closet with the price tag still on it. And so this is one of the best ways to get rid of things in your house, declutter your house, and make some extra money.
How much can you make?
Well, you know, it was interesting. According to the Home Business Center, the average household can make about $600 profit from a one-weekend garage sale. Now, that's a pretty good amount of money. I mean, it certainly would take care of some holiday shopping this year.
Okay, so people should just do that, just open up their garage, put out their stuff that they don't want, and, you know, hope people buy it?
I hope you do a little bit of work before you have the garage sale. It does take a little bit of work. You want to basically research your items, see what you have in your house, see what they're going for at other garage sales. Like, visit the competition before you decide to have a garage sale. Go around the neighborhood and see how people are doing and what they're selling. You also want to check with the local officials to see what local laws and regulations you need to adhere to, if there are any. You know, and here's a really good trick. Price the items for more than you want, because anybody who goes to a garage sale or flea market wants to bargain. So if you want a dollar for those pair of pants, you know, put it up for $2 so that people feel like they're getting a deal. The retailers do it all the time.
As we're seeing now, right?
That's right. And listen, talk to your neighbors. You could maybe have, like, I live on a cul-de-sac, and if you talk to all your neighbors, you could all have tables out and do sort of a garage sale. You get more people in, and, you know, you could all pool the funds and then split it among all of you, or each take your own pile. But that's a good way to generate more business for your garage sale.
Okay, so what about other methods, selling online or going to a consignment shop?
You know, it's interesting. Consignment selling is up. Even as we see a lot of retail businesses going out of business and closing stores, like one of my favorite stores, Linen and Things, is going out of business. But the one area that's showing growth is consignment stores. There are a growth of consignment stores, and more people are taking their things to consignment shops. And, you know, there's two ways to make money. They either pay you outright for the things, or you give it to them on consignment, and then they sell it, and they give you a percentage of what they make. Typically anywhere from 25, probably more in the 50% range. You also have to watch out for administrative fees, because they'll charge you because they are taking on the sales effort to sell your stuff.
And then you can also go on Craigslist.
That's right. Craigslist, eBay. You know, do a lot of research before you do those, because there's a whole procedure involved and you want to set up a payment system so that you can get your funds, and be very, very careful about scams. You want to do a little research before you try to sell some of your items online. But that is an effective way to raise money. And lots of people are doing that. They have set up all little, you know, side businesses by selling their things online.
Michelle Singletary is the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, where she writes the Color of Money column. Thanks, Michelle.
You're welcome.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand. The stock market is finally back to its fair value, even after yesterday's horrendous plunge of nearly 700 points. That's what Henry Blodgett says. He's the editor of ClusterStock.com. Welcome back, Henry.
Thank you very much. Glad
to
be here.
So what do you mean? What do you mean that stocks are back to their fair value?
Well, after yesterday's plunge, happy to say that they're now modestly undervalued, which is encouraging. But everyone talks about the P.E. ratio of the stock market, which is the price to the earnings of the companies. And what people often do when they look at that is they look at a single year's of earnings, and then they take their P.E. ratio back on that. And if it's more than 15, they say it's overvalued. And if it's under 15, they say it's undervalued. The problem with that is that earnings change as profit margins change. And really, if you step back and you just draw a line through earnings for the last 100 years, what you find is that they grow on average about 6%. And if you just draw that straight line and you plot the stock prices over the period, what you find is that sometimes stock prices are well above the average PE line and sometimes they're well below. And what I was saying is that they have now finally gotten back to average after being overvalued for about 15 years.
And average being less than 15?
Average is about 15 times. That's if you go back about 100 years and you calculate earnings the way that I just talked about, where you average out the business cycle and you take an average profit margin, you get a PE of about 15 times, slightly less. But so 15 is a good number to use. And we are now slightly below that on that measure.
That would surprise a lot of people who think that they look at their portfolio and they just see it going into the gutter.
And who can blame them? As it happens, over the last 15 to 20 years, stocks have been well above that average. And now that we've had this precipitous collapse, we've actually come down to the average or just below the average in the case of today. And the good news about that is that if you are a long-term investor, you can actually feel more comfortable adding money to the stock market than at any time in the past 15 years, with the exception of a couple of minutes in 2003 when we got down to this level. And I should stress again, that does not mean that we're not headed lower. I think we probably are in the near term. But over the longer term, this is actually an average valuation and you should get an average return.
And what is an average return?
Average return for the S&P 500 is about 10% a year.
And so what would you say to people who are thinking, okay, I'll buy in right now. Where should they go? Should they go with index funds or should they go with individual stocks?
Index funds are just the wise play for the vast majority of investors. And the reason is that it turns out that it is incredibly difficult to pick stocks that are going to do better than average and not pick stocks that are going to do worse. And everybody has good ideas once in a while, and you always remember those, and you tend to forget about your losers because they're such horrific memories. But it turns out that on average, the best way to go is index funds. Part of the reason there is that they just cost a lot less. You don't have to put a lot of effort into it. So you end up getting a better return than the majority of investors by buying index funds. In terms of what people should do now, obviously, psychologically, it's incredibly difficult to continue to add money to the stock market as it continues to go down. But I think the wise play, again, is to just stick to your long-term investment plan. If you have figured out over time that you can't handle the volatility of the stock market and it's just too painful, you probably are overweighted in stocks and you probably have too much near-term money in the stock market. And stock market isn't for near-term money. It really is for this long-term investment. And I just think you should continue to invest modestly over time and stick with your long-term allocation of stocks, bonds, and cash.
Henry Blodgett is the editor of ClusterStock.com and providing us with a dose of, I don't know, phew, I guess. I don't know.
I feel a little reassured.
I feel a little reassured talking to you. Thanks, Henry.
Thanks for having me.
According to numbers recently released, American banks will have cut 200,000 jobs this year. That comes on top of 153,000 cut last year.
Whether you work on Wall Street or in one of the European markets, it might be a good time to think about a new profession. One European trader did just that. It was back when the going was good and he was making millions.
But he left to go into a monastery. He now heads a fraternity of monks in Marseille, France. Here to tell us about it, John Lawrenson.
Henry Quinson leading his brother monks in evening prayer. We're in an apartment, and in the long silences between chants, you can hear the neighbors yelling at each other. 20 years ago, this 40-something Franco-American was a young currency trader. He gave it all up to join a monastery before becoming what he calls, with a grin, an inner-city monk, setting up this fraternity among the high-rise projects of Marseille.
I was a trader with Bank Indosuez, and we were making a lot of money very quickly, and I was doing very well with that bank. So when I was 28, I had Merrill Lynch, an American investment bank, calling me every day, literally every day, and saying, you know, you could get this if you went to work with us in London. And so I had to make up my mind, you know, what was I going to do with my life? And so one day I just, you know, came to my bank as every day and actually resigned.
But Quinson didn't join Merrill Lynch in London. He joined a silent order of Cistercian monks in the French Alps. Instead of currency options, he made cheese. But even then, he had an inkling that the traditional monastic life wasn't for him.
When I was about to leave Paris to join this monastery, I had this vision as I was praying, and I actually saw myself in Marseille. I knew nobody there, had never been there, and I was in Marseille with children, obviously coming from the south part of the Mediterranean, and helping them out for their schoolwork.
Six-year-old Thomas getting some help with his reading. Henry Quinson has turned his vision into a reality. Every day after school, neighborhood kids, some with serious learning difficulties, cram into this apartment-turned-classroom for tutoring on school basics from Quinson and the other monks in his fraternity. It's a far cry from his former life.
When I think about the way I was living when I was a trader, I was living in Paris, in a very famous part of Paris, a very expensive apartment, and I had to cross the River Seine, and I went through the Champs-Élysées, and in 4 years, nobody ever, ever said hello. When I go to work here, I always have people saying hello.
S'amuser.
Life is much easier. I mean, I don't have to think about my portfolio of $15 billion. What is it going to do after the weekend?
Well, what did you do with your money? Because you were rich before.
Well, I actually got rid of it. I mean, I gave it to different non-profit organizations.
Giving away your wealth is, in any case, better than losing it when the markets collapse. But for Quinson, who used to make millions on those markets, even the current financial upheaval has its positive spiritual side.
This crisis reminds us that although money is useful, and I really believe that, money is not our master. What's your relationship to money? Is it your goal in life to become richer and richer? Or is your goal in life, you know, to make the planet happy? And do you view human life through the eyes of someone who knows that, you know, one day you will die and you're working also for other generations? And maybe you're working for a better world that is also an eternal world. Maybe what really counts is the love you can put into your human life.
For NPR News, I'm John Lawrenson.
Back now with Day to Day, Internet for Everyone. That's the general idea put forth today by a coalition of advocacy groups and the tech industry. They are calling on Congress and President-elect Barack Obama to come up with a national broadband strategy. But as Joel Rose reports in this installment of our Memo to the President series, such proposals face opposition from both the cable and telecom industries.
President-elect Barack Obama has not said who he'll appoint to lead the FCC next year or what the commission's priorities will be. But if the people advising the transition team are any indication, high-speed internet access may be near the top of the list.
This really is a utility. This is like water, electricity, sewage systems, something that all Americans need in order to succeed in the modern era.
That's University of Michigan law professor Susan Crawford, one of two people charged with advising the Obama-Biden transition team on the FCC. Crawford declined to be interviewed for this story, but she did speak at a roundtable discussion earlier this year at the Tech Policy Summit in Los Angeles. Also on that panel was a White House science advisor, Ambassador Richard Russell.
The bottom line is that the U.S. is still, I think, the most dynamic broadband economy in the world.
Susan Crawford called that, quote, magical thinking.
We're not doing it all well. for reasons that mostly have to do with the fact that we failed to have a U.S. industrial policy pushing forward high-speed internet access.
That's exactly what many of the FCC's critics have been waiting to hear. Ben Scott is the policy director for the nonprofit group Free Press.
We simply don't have enough competition in our broadband markets.
Scott says Americans are paying more for less, which is why the U.S. has fallen out of the top 10 countries in the world when it comes to the percentage of households using broadband. Right now, just over half of American homes have it. That puts us behind Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Switzerland, Iceland, Sweden.
If you look overseas, most of the world's leading nations have half a dozen or more different companies offering a similar broadband product. They're competing on price, they're competing on speed, they're competing on the attractiveness of the services that they offer on top of their broadband package.
So in London, for instance, there are at least 9 internet providers offering a range of services starting at the equivalent of $10 a month. They can do that, says Scott, because governments abroad have worked with industry to lay wires and equipment that are used by multiple providers. Contrast that with the U.S., where phone and cable companies enjoy a duopoly in most markets. But there's plenty of competition in the U.S., according to Joe Waz. He's a spokesman for Comcast Corporation, the nation's largest cable company and its second largest internet provider.
Speeds have kept going up. Prices have stayed flat on a real dollar basis and have continued to decline in terms of the price per megabit delivered.
Waz says his competitors at the phone companies are investing billions of dollars in faster fiber optic networks. And in some places, cable companies are responding by opening up more of their channels to broadband, but not everywhere. About 10% of Americans still have no access to broadband at all. Many of those people live in rural areas. Wally Bowen runs a small internet company in Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, the cable companies don't find it cost-effective. Phone companies have to reconfigure their landlines with additional technology. And there's been some of that, but it's been pretty limited.
Bowen and others hope that new wireless technologies recently approved by the FCC will eventually solve the rural broadband problem. But even Comcast Corporation's Joe Waz says this is one issue that could benefit from government intervention.
I think the smart use of government funds, to the extent that we care to put them into broadband infrastructure, would be to bring broadband where it isn't.
Waz warns that cable and phone companies won't build new infrastructure where they don't expect to make money. Current FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell agrees. He says the FCC has already taken steps to encourage more private investment in broadband infrastructure.
I think we need to be wary of any policy that might scare away capital, especially given the state of the capital markets today. I don't think just a $100 billion taxpayer-funded program to wire up America is the right way to go right now.
But Free Press's Ben Scott isn't so sure. Scott says there is a precedent for this kind of major public-private partnership in American history.
I look at this as a real Eisenhower moment. You look back at the 1950s and the government and the private sector got together and they've triggered investment in our highway systems. We need to have a similar 21st century highway bill where we invest in our broadband infrastructure.
That information highway won't be easy to build. Scott says such a plan would require unprecedented leadership from the White House, Congress, and most of all, the FCC, because it's likely to face vigorous opposition from cable and telecom companies. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
Finally today, this season we are offering you, our listeners, a few radio gifts. These are things you've asked to hear on our program.
And they're free. Today, a gift to listener Kevin Keck of Oakland, California. He's a former Amtrak attendant. His wish, to hear the whistle of a train.
So, Kevin Keck, here is your radio gift.
That train whistle was recorded near Cass, West Virginia, by NPR's Bill Deputy. And thanks to our NPR colleague, Noah Adams, for getting it to us.
We're still taking suggestions for radio gifts. Do you have an idea for a story? Is there someone you think would make a great interview? Or maybe there's just a special sound you'd like to hear. Go to our blog at npr.org/daydreaming and let us know about it.
Look yonder coming, coming down that railroad track. Hey, look yonder coming, coming down that railroad track. It's the Orange Blossom Special, bringing my baby back.